Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Canadian PodCow. Thanks for choosing to listen to us today. My name's Andrew Campbell, and I'm very happy to be here in Ottawa on location with my friend and co-host Sarah Sash at the Dairy Farmers of Canada's annual policy conference.
Great to see you, Andrew. It's always pretty fun to be back in person recording episodes.
It is great. We saw each other a few weeks ago in Toronto, and a lot has changed over the last few weeks in terms of political landscape here in Canada, political landscape with the U.S. So it's actually a pretty exciting time to be in Ottawa.
Yeah, I you could say that. I mean, it's definitely an interesting time to be in Ottawa.
Exciting, interesting, WTF. I don't know which is the best one to describe, but it is definitely one of those where I think just to be kind of within an Ottawa bubble to get some of the perspectives from people here in Ottawa has been pretty interesting with the policy conference, including a pretty special guest today, Sarah.
Yeah, we're going to get some pretty good perspective, I can tell you. We had a wonderful presentation today by Nick Nanos from Nanos Research, and we're fortunate we've been able to lock him down for an episode of the PodCow.
We have. Thanks for listening to the Canadian PodCow.
Our guest today is a data wizard and a trend tracker, the founder and chief data scientist at one of Canada's most prestigious research firms, Nanos Research. He is the go-to pollster for CTV News, The Globe and Mail, and Bloomberg News.
When he's not crunching numbers, he's serving as a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in D.C.
You've likely seen Nick breaking down the latest political drama, and I do mean drama, on CTV News channels Nanos on the Numbers. Nick Nanos, welcome to the Canadian PodCow.
Great to join you.
So, Nick, let's start with the big picture, because you gave us a lot of data today, obviously focusing a lot on the political scene, but let's go to Canadians themselves for a little bit and just give us a bit of a picture in terms of where are they right now in their feeling of what Canada is.
Am I supposed to cheer you up?
I would prefer, I would prefer the facts, which weren't the most uplifting.
Okay.
But
okay.
I think the reality of where Canadians are right now, which probably doesn't surprise any of us.
Yeah, kind of like the Buckley's cough syrup situation where it doesn't taste good, but it's the truth and works. You know, the thing is that we've been tracking sentiment. You know, I've been in the business now for 35 years, and we've been tracking, we ask questions like, do they think Canada's moving in the right or wrong direction and how satisfied they are? What we're seeing is Canadians are increasingly dissatisfied with Canada as a country, especially young people. You know, young people who are struggling to pay for the bills, struggling to pay for the rent, worried about the future and their standard of living, that they're actually quite negative and quite pessimistic. Maybe the good news is, and I'd like to think this, is that the numbers are so dismal that they can only get better. No, and you know, you're laughing while I say that, but you know, the thing is that, you know, when only about, you know, 2 out of 10 Canadians think that the country's moving in the right direction, when, you know, very few Canadians think that our international reputation is improving, that, you know, perhaps we're at a low now and Canadians are ready for the numbers to go up.
So you did use the word dismal in your presentation, and I'll admit it stuck with me. It's not a word you hear every day. I'm wondering, what's at the root of this? Why are Canadians feeling this way?
I think, you know, think of it this way. Canadians aren't experts in the economy. They're not experts in foreign relations and diplomacy and stuff like that. But they do know a number of things. So first of all, because we're a trading nation, that our relationship with other economies, the United States, India, and China, is actually critically important. And what they do know is that over the last number of years, that our relationship with the United States has been strained. Our relationship with India has been strained. Our relationship with China has been under some negative pressure, and that it's almost like nothing is going right. So there's that, knowing that having trade, access to markets, being critical to jobs and prosperity in Canada, and then that's at the big level, and then at the personal level, it's people just struggling to pay for the bills and to get ahead, and people feeling pessimistic about the future. Parents wondering whether their kids will be able to have the same type of vacation as, or that the kids will be able to live in the same type of house that they grew up in. So there's, you know, the mood is, a lot of it is drawn by everybody working hard but not being able to get ahead. And this is where the cost of living and worry about the kind of broader global environment kind of kicks in.
Because that's, and this is kind of going back to your experience in that data. Is that usually what happens? Because I think it isn't surprising for us to know that people are concerned about inflation, jobs, yep, things like that. Does that usually translate into just this kind of dismal feeling for the country on the international stage? Or is that a bit unique that not only are we worried about ourselves, but we're worried about ourselves in a global economy?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is an accumulation effect. Not just in terms of what people are worried about, but it's kind of like, you know, young people and thinking, okay, so I don't have the job that I wanted to have coming out of university, but I can make by. But look what's happening on the environment. We're not having, you know, for young people, action on the environment is not moving fast enough. So, and then they think of, you know, the war in Ukraine and the war between Hamas and the state of Israel. And there's a new generation that had never really before worried about kind of a global escalation of tension, right? So it's kind of like everything's going wrong, right? Our trade relationships are under stress. It's hard to pay the bills. We can't move forward on the environment. And the risk of conflict, especially between the United States and China, is increased and enhanced because of these wars that are taking place between Ukraine and Russia and also in the Middle East.
So with everything going on, having the economy as a main concern is not surprising. Is it making them super worried, hyper worried right now?
Yeah. And, you know, it makes them, you know, maybe one way to think of it, and this, you know, I'll probably regret saying this on your podcast, is that, you know, are we making people hunter-gatherers? A hunter-gatherer wakes up in the morning and they don't know where their meal is going to come from. A hunter-gatherer wakes up and doesn't know how, whether there'll be shelter for them or how they're going to get through. And think of it this way. If we're creating an environment where an increasing proportion of citizens, especially young people, are hunter-gatherers, and it's a crass and crude way to say it, and I'll probably regret saying it, how do we talk to them about prosperity, and how do we talk to them about international relations, and how do we talk to them about all those things that we need to talk about, the environment? So, you know, I think perhaps the one good piece of news out of the stress that the Trump administration has put on our country is perhaps, just perhaps, politicians will wake up, and perhaps Canadians will wake up too to say, you know what, we need to make sure that our federation works. We need to, you know, be thinking about how we can be more competitive. We need to be more strategic on where jobs are going to come from. And we need to make those investments and we need to make sacrifices. You know, the interesting thing on a lot of the polling that we've done is that if you ask Canadians to make a sacrifice, they will do it if there is a purpose. If you ask them to make a sacrifice and you don't explain to them why, then they're going to be like, why? Why should I do that? And I think we're at a particularly special moment in time where perhaps our politicians can move on how we make the Federation stronger and to think about how we're going to be how we're going to create prosperity as opposed to just focusing on the day-to-day shiny objects that might be on social media and trying to score cute political points in the House of Commons.
I do love your optimism after 35 years that politicians will wake up. Very nice. But I think it actually does lead into, you know, you talked about prosperity here. You talked about a prosperity narrative as being kind of one of those next stages that could we use in Canada. I guess, what does that look like? You talked a little bit about jobs and things like that, but what does that look like particularly for a young Canadian that, as you said before, is giving us kind of a D grade in terms of where we are as a country? Like, where do we need to invest? What do we need to build so that we do have kind of this prosperity narrative, especially for them?
Yeah, I think we need to create an environment where individual citizens and especially young people feel that they can take control and responsibility and can shape their future. And this goes back to, you know, if we are focused on, you know, the part of the dominant narrative over the last decade has been the whole idea of income inequality. And it's been on the right wing and the left wing, right? In terms of trying to deal with income inequality. And what I think, at least, is there's probably room for politicians and governments and elected officials to focus more on income mobility. Basically to say, hey, you know what? We need to create an environment where if you work hard, that you can pay the bills. That if you work hard, you can provide for your family. If you work hard, you can plan for your future. And that maybe you'll succeed, maybe you won't succeed, but that will be totally within your control. And I think we're probably, moving, you know, on the pendulum front, we're probably moving to a space where I think that's where politics is going to go. And that's where, and you know, we've seen it a little bit where the government, and why don't we just use the capital gains tax, where the government introduced a change because the government is focused on and wants to reduce income inequality. But there was a lot of pushback because, and the pushback was basically a result of the fact that people believe that if they work hard, they should be able to have some sort of portion of that. And you know, the thing is what the government was missing from that was, okay, so if we want to have a capital gains, if we want to change the capital gains regime, they didn't explain why beyond income inequality. Like if they had said, okay, this capital gains tax is going to raise so much money and here's how we're going to invest it in the future. So we're asking everybody to sacrifice, everyone that's in that world to sacrifice a little bit to know that we're going to invest in certain sectors of the economy. We're going to help as many young people get trained so that we can improve and have a competitive. That was what was missing.
Goes back to your same point you said earlier, like they need a reason to be able to give up something.
Exactly.
Even if they weren't eligible for a capital gains exemption or tax, they still seem to take it to heart. Well, what if I did?
Yeah. No, 100%. So that's what I thought the government was missing. It's kind of like not, you know, their intent, because governments can do what they want. But from an engagement point of view with citizens, they didn't say, this is the sacrifice that we're asking people who are in this particular economic situation, which is more comfortable than others, to do. We're asking the sacrifice. The sacrifice will help the country writ large, right? And that our economy will get stronger and we're going to make investments and we need, you know, that needs to take place. But we didn't hear that. We just like, we'll take the money because you're making too much money. Thank you very much.
I think that loss of control that you speak of really resonates in terms of how Canadians are feeling. There's so much more to talk about on this. We'll be right back with Nick Nanos after the break.
As Canadian dairy farmers, we follow ProAction, Dairy Farmers of Canada's national quality assurance program with 6 modules. Modules like milk quality, that stands for high standards of milk production. Or food safety, producing milk that meets 42 requirements. And animal care, that means caring for every cow. ProAction sets standards of excellence. That's what's behind the Blue Cow logo. Dairy Farmers of Canada.
And we're back with Nick Nanos from Nanos Research. Nick, the big item in the news, of course, has been the return of Donald Trump in the White House. I'm shocked we made it past the break and didn't talk a whole lot about that. The threat of tariffs, looming trade wars, et cetera, et cetera. Canada's trade relationships. How do Canadians feel about how we need to handle Donald Trump specifically? Well, and how is that, you know, is that going to be the ballot question as we head into whatever the election might be?
Yeah, that's a bit of a moving target in terms of how Canadians are feeling about how we should be reacting to Donald Trump. Until the T word, tariff, was bandied about, you know, our polling suggested that Canadians wanted to not escalate things quickly, that they wanted to start off with a diplomatic and let's talk and let's have diplomacy and let's try to and that slapping tariffs was kind of like after diplomacy had been exhausted. What we've seen, especially in the last 3 weeks, is Canadians are much more willing to accept an escalation to a tit for tat in terms of an immediate kind of counter measure, which suggests that the current approach, generally from the prime minister and the premiers that they've been working on together, I'm not going to say whether it's a good or bad approach because that's different. I'm in the public opinion world. That approach is supported by Canadians. And, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, for Canadians, they know that the relationship will be under stress. And I think for a lot of Canadians, they know that Donald Trump is a tough negotiator. So, you know, if you're dealing with a tough negotiator, you can't roll over immediately. You've got to, you've got to respond. And, you know, maybe one thing, and I think, you know, where the premiers, many of them have said, our first choice is not to put tariffs, countervailing tariffs, but if needed, we will. And I think that probably sums up how Canadians feel. Our first choice is not to get into a tariff war with a country that we can't win. However, if you force us to, we will have to kind of respond.
And in that same thing, when you talk about what Canadians feel, you know, we're kind of in this mess along with Mexico, who's also in this mess. And now, you know, there's tariffs against China and there's threatened tariffs in the EU and kind of everybody's a target now. What do you think Canadians think in terms of their approach? Should we be just, nope, we're going to deal directly with the US, we'll make our own deal, we'll do that? Or is there more of an approach that, wait, we should work with everybody else who is under attack here to try to either build a strategy that can collectively go, not necessarily against the US, but, you know, kind of focus on the US, or kind of a whole new narrative where it's just all of us together and we'll let the US do their thing?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when we ask Canadians, because, you know, one of the interesting things in this round of discussions about the binational relationship or the North American free trade relationship is, you know, the talk about throwing Mexico under the bus. I think Premier Doug Ford in Ontario was the first to say, maybe we should be negotiating without Mexico, right, kind of deal. Sure, the Mexicans weren't too happy with that one. But, you know, it's interesting when we actually poll on that, Canadians are almost evenly split. About just as many Canadians would support or somewhat support Canada going alone and throwing Mexico. I mean, we didn't ask the question, should we throw Mexico under the bus?
That was the
scientific poll actually asked whether we should negotiate separately from the Mexicans. But about just as many thought that we should negotiate separately as to negotiate together. And I think that's because I think there are some Canadians who are thinking, we have a special relationship with the United States and perhaps we can negotiate a special deal, right? And then other Canadians who think there's no way that we can, you know, do a bilat with the US and have leverage, that we probably have more leverage if we're dealing with Mexico. But I think, you know, the broader question that you put on the table about tariffs is we're starting to learn, are the tariffs real? Or are they just a negotiating ploy? So we saw with the government of Colombia, you know, the Colombian president didn't want to accept migrant workers coming back. Donald Trump threatened a tariff, and then they came to a deal. Donald Trump threatened tariffs at Mexico. And, you know, the president of Mexico only needed one telephone call to do that. She did it in the first call. We needed two. And, you know, he's given a reprieve. For some of the folks, I'm in D.C. We've done polling in the U.S. for 20 years, and I'm in D.C. a lot. The general consensus is that there won't be a 25% tariff, but there could be a tariff regime that's introduced in the United States. Probably not 25%, but it's kind of like, think of it this way. If we try to game out Trump as a negotiator, 25 is the start, and he'd probably take something that's less. And, you know, the other thing that I wouldn't underestimate is that, you know, he's picked on Canada because he thinks that he can pick on Canada. And that he uses Canada as an example to tell other countries or other regions like Europe, China. And I would put Mexico in that because Mexico is more of a problem. And we're not a problem when it comes to the border. On if you don't comply with what I want you to do, do you see what's happening to Canada? That could happen to you.
So President Trump, if he's going to call Canada, needs to know who to call. And I feel a little bit like there's some concern amongst the population that, you know, first everyone was calling upon, or many parties were calling on Justin Trudeau to resign. He's now resigned. The political landscape is quite complex. The opposition parties are keen to have an election. We don't really know what's going to happen with the Liberal Party of Canada. Obviously, they're searching for a new leader. What can you tell us about that whole thing?
Well, I think the good news is that because of the Liberal leadership situation, it's put a bigger spotlight on the premiers cooperating. Like, they've stepped up, right? And they've stepped up big time. So I think that has been good because we need as much of a unified policy as possible. And that's actually what Canadians want. It also means that if we look ahead to where we'll be, that there will be an opportunity to reset the relationship because there will be a new prime minister. The Liberals will have a new leader. We don't know how long that person might be prime minister, or the Conservatives will form a government. So we have to think that actually there, because of that situation, that although we're in kind of a bit of a purgatory, for your Catholic listeners, you know exactly what I mean, but you're in a bit of a holding room, a little hot, but not quite hot. There's an opportunity, there will be an opportunity to reset. So I think that's actually the good news, because we obviously have a reprieve, at least for the short term. And you know what? Donald Trump will want to know who he's negotiating with. Like, why would, just to be completely harsh, like, why would he spend time dealing with any leader of a country that has already said that they're resigning? He's the president of the United States. Really? Like, yeah, we're friends, but he's got a job to do. And, you know, he's probably waiting to see who's actually going to be the leader of Canada, who's going to lead the next parliament so that I can have discussions with the person who's the real decision maker on this. So I think yes, it's a risk in the short term, but I think there will be an opportunity for a reset depending on who the Liberals pick and what happens in the next election and if Pierre Poilievre potentially wins.
So then thinking about that election and Pierre Poilievre, the last polling data I saw before yours today was maybe 2 weeks ago.
Yep.
With the Conservatives in a 25 to 30 point lead. Like, Pierre will form the next government. Won't it be easy? Your data was not so rosy for the Conservatives. Not that they're not in the lead still.
Yep.
But there's been a big shift over the last couple of weeks. Talk about it.
Yeah, there's been a noticeable change. And, you know, the thing is, what's ironic is that literally the night or the weekend before Justin Trudeau stepped down, the Conservatives had a whopping 27-point advantage, right? It was like 47-20. Supermajority. That's supermajority territory for the Conservative Party of Canada. But, you know, we have to realize that for any federal party to hold a 27-point advantage on a sustained basis is almost impossible. And, you know, I'd always kind of say that polls before elections are kind of like the equity of parties is kind of like the equity in stocks on the market, that sometimes stocks are undervalued, sometimes stocks are overvalued, that with the Conservatives at 47%, that's an overvalued stock. Yes, it is time for a change. Yes, Pierre Poilievre has been consistent. Yes, people are angry at the Liberals, and they definitely didn't like Justin Trudeau. But for the Conservatives to keep that 27-point advantage was not realistic. I think the Conservative advantage realistically is somewhere between 8 to 15%. And, you know, that could change. Now, what's happened, at least in the last couple of weeks, is that the Liberals are starting to gain steam. And, you know, the margin between the two front-running parties, when people switch between the two parties, it changes really fast. Because if the Liberals are up 5 points and the Conservatives are down 5 points, the 27-point advantage is a 17-point advantage. And that could just happen over a 10-day cycle. So that's what we're seeing. The interesting thing is that when we look beneath the numbers, the first type of voter to move away from the Liberals, move away from the Conservatives towards the Liberals, have actually been women. Right? That they're the first group. It's like Trudeau's out, and then it'd be like, okay, you know, like, let's face it, the Conservatives at 47%, those aren't all Conservatives. No. There are Liberals. There are Liberals there, right? In that group. So what we're seeing is, you know, women starting to come back. And, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, when we look at the the winning franchise for the liberals and the conservatives. They're kind of mirror images of themselves. For the conservatives, it's do well among men and competitive among women. And, you know, when the conservatives are at 47%, they're doing well among men and women. It's like supermajority territory. For the liberals, it's do well among women and to be competitive among men. And now we're seeing the liberals are now being more competitive among women. They're not ahead, but they're more competitive than they have been in the past, and that's changed their political fortunes. So, you know, that said, you know, expectations for the liberals are so low, right? When their numbers go up, it's like, they're not dead, right? And then for, you know, for Pierre Poilievre, it's like, you know, a 15-point advantage, I'm angry that I only have a 15-point advantage. What's wrong with Canadians? That's probably what Pierre Poilievre in his office is saying. Not realizing is like, hey, you know, in 2022, if someone said you've got a 10 or 15-point advantage, you wouldn't be saying I'll turn my nose up on that and I'll be angry at Canadians. But that's, you know, the reality is for the Conservatives, they still have an advantage. And, you know, the election will matter, you know, because this isn't going to be an election about the carbon tax, because the Liberal candidates have taken that off the table, the leadership candidates. And it's probably going to be about who can manage, best manage Donald Trump. That's going to be when people look at the choices, who can best manage Donald Trump. And that's going to be especially important in the context of the next prime minister, whoever they might be, being able to have a reset. There's a reset opportunity for whoever wins.
So how about the other parties in the mix then? I mean, we do have other parties in Canada. We haven't been hearing the most convincing things about Mr. Singh in the media lately. Nobody really seems to know what he's thinking. But what's the potential for the NDP in a situation like this, or even for the Bloc? We've heard some things about the potential of a Bloc opposition. Do you want to weigh in a little bit on those before we move on?
Yeah, no, a Bloc, you know, in the, I'll call it in the conservative supermajority world, the Bloc opposition was definitely a possibility. And you know, in our seat projections, it was basically a coin toss between the Liberals and the Bloc to form the official opposition. Quite important considering there'll be also be a PQ government likely. Not for sure, but there's a good chance of a PQ government. So, you know, and you know what? Blanchet is solid. Let's set aside his politics, right? He's very measured. He does well in the English debates. Here's a little, can I tell you a little bit of polling trivia?
Oh, yeah.
So a little bit of polling trivia.
Yes, please.
Every election that we've done polling in that the Bloc have run candidates and had a leader, the day after the English debate, the first question that I ask my team when I look at the numbers, how many people in Alberta say they want to vote for the Bloc? Because they're like watching the English debate and they're like, hey, that Bloc guy.
Not that.
He sounds pretty good. I wish we had someone like that. No, they go like, I wish we had someone like that, where that's all their job is to get, advocate for their province and advocate and ask with the Federation and to represent us. So that's usually for a couple of days where, you know, we get a couple Bloc voters and then, you know, it's after the English debate and we go off. So you know, you have to think of the Bloc as the leader as credible and them as credible. And you have to think of, in a world where people are unhappy or faced imperfect choices, that the Bloc is kind of like the easiest place to vote because they are a popular front that are not expected to win, that don't need a platform, that's all they have to do is to say, we're going to be in the House of Commons, we're going to get as much as we can out of the Federation for the province of Quebec. So they've got the easiest job in town. Jagmeet Singh, more difficult, because actually for him and the New Democrats, it's all about who can challenge the Conservatives. And that's why when the New Democrat numbers become competitive with the Liberals, it's easy for the NDP to jump ahead, right? Because people go, hey, you know, Liberals are a little tired. We'll look at the NDP. And, you know, that's why leaders like Jack Layton and Tom Mulcair were successful, because they were seen as credible alternatives, progressive alternatives to the Conservatives. So, but, you know, if we see the Liberals 7 points, 8 points ahead of the New Democrats, there'll be New Democratic voters that are like, well, we don't like the Liberals, but we hate the Conservatives, so we're going to strategically vote Liberals. So, you know, the NDP have to watch out for that. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, for Jagmeet Singh, he's got to articulate something new in the campaign. Like, what's new that the New Democrats are going to put on the table? And he also has to explain how Canadians have benefited from him having his having the parliamentary arrangement and supporting the Liberals. And to say, hey, one, two, three, these are the things that we've delivered on. You've never gotten this under the Liberals, but it's because the New Democrats did this that that Canadians enjoy dental care and stuff like that. So he's got to hammer those two things, but he's got to distance himself at the same time. And he's going to take the cheap shots from everybody else who's going to say, hey, you know, there's no difference. You've been propped up in an unpopular government for a long time.
So then is your prediction based on all of this that we're going to have an election sometime in the early mid-spring? Or how do you think this all plays out over the next few months?
Well, the election will happen whenever politicians think it's in their best interests and who's in control. So if the House is sitting, it'll be the Conservatives in the driver's seat, primarily driving a non-confidence vote. You know, for the Liberals, you got to wonder why even come back to Parliament just to get punched in the face. Just to get punched in the face, right? By the Conservatives. So we're like, the Conservatives are like, oh my goodness, the Liberals showed up to the House of Commons. Well, let's punch them in the face and let's kick them in another place. You know, like let's do the things that we're really good at. So why would the Liberals even show up for that when the Conservatives are very good? So, you know, no one knows, no one knows who's going to win the next Liberal leadership. We have two front runners, Mark Carney and Chrystia Freeland. My expectation is that Carney probably has an advantage as an outsider. And, you know, for the Liberals, I would not be surprised, and I'm not privy to any inside information, but just looking at things to say, why prolong what's going to be a difficult election? If you see the numbers start trending in the right direction as a result of your leadership race, call an election before prorogation or have an election before prorogation and then you know, go to the polls in the spring, and then, you know, the Conservatives in the Bloc are not going to complain about calling an early election.
No, they'll be very happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, this was great, Nick, in terms of some picture of the political landscape, you know, what the heck is happening with U.S.-Canada relations. But then obviously, you know, kind of the optimistic side, that with a prosperity narrative that, you know, maybe we can kind of pull together as Canadians and kind of bring ourselves out of this place we're in that maybe isn't quite as optimistic and get back to a very optimistic Canada. So Nick Nanos, thanks for all your words today.
Great to join you.
No shortage of things to talk about there.
Actually, you know what, it's been an interesting day here at the policy conference, just because when you're in Ottawa in an environment that is changing so quickly right now, given the political landscape here in Canada, given the U.S. relationship, given just kind of where everybody's at, it's great to talk to somebody like Nick to ground it a little bit, to say just here's where the data is, here's where Canadians are at, to just kind of help us at least get a bit more of a perspective of where we can be going.
Yeah, I'll agree with you there. It's pretty supercharged right now. It feels kind of intense. And I think to Nick's point, just what can you control in all of this? So it was nice to be able to hear some data. Yeah, like you say, think about where are the points that we actually could change things.
And I really do like that prosperity narrative. And obviously, because I am, you know, very optimistic on rural Canada and agriculture and all of those types of things, you know, it sounds like a great opportunity for us to kind of highlight what we can do in agriculture to be able to build that prosperity for Canada.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of Canada going forward. It certainly has been in the past, and I think there's a lot of opportunity. So that's it for this time on the Canadian Podcast. We can extensively thank our guest, Nick Nanos from Nanos Research.
A huge thanks to our production team, Bruce Sargent and Carl Bellanger. They're both here with us on location in Ottawa.
Some of my favorite times of the year. And this episode is also possible thanks to the generous support of Dairy Farmers of Canada.
Check out our other episodes available at CanadianPodCow.ca or your favorite streaming platform. Or you can even see us on YouTube, Sarah.
Who would not want to do that? So thank you all. We'll see you soon for another episode of the Canadian Podcast.